From the studios of WMUB Oxford, this is WMUB Forum. I'm John Hingsbergen, inviting you to join in as we welcome our guests and as we encourage you to be part of today's discussion. In June, the Senate Judiciary Committee held hearings about the use of signing statements by the Bush administration. Testimony relayed concern among legislators, scholars, and legal experts that the practice has gone too far in expanding presidential powers. Committee Chairman Arlen Specter introduced legislation that would allow Congress to sue the president over his authority to enforce statements that he adds to laws he has signed. We're going to encourage you to join our conversation as we talk about presidential signing statements and separation of powers today. Your questions and comments are welcome throughout the program. And we will invite you to send an email to forum@wmub.org or call in, and we'll get to phones in a few minutes after we introduce our guests and get into the topic. The phone number, though, is 888-877-3885. If you get on the line, be prepared to wait a few minutes, and then we'll get you on the air with your questions, your comments, or your personal stories. Again, that's 888-877-3885, the email forum@wmub.org. On today's program, we welcome to WMEB Studio F Dr. Christopher Kelly. Chris Kelly is a visiting assistant professor of political science at Miami University. He is one of few scholars researching presidential signing statements. Kelly edited a recently released collection of essays about the changing nature of presidential power titled Executing the Constitution, and he also maintains his own blog called Media Watch. We're going to want to hear about that blog and how people can access that.
Sure.
Welcome, Chris Kelly.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you back on the program. I know you've been here in the past. Also joining us is Bruce Fine. Bruce is a member of the American Bar Association Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements, and he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the issue. He's a constitutional lawyer and an international consultant with the Litchfield Group in Washington, D.C. He also writes a weekly column on legal and international affairs for the Washington Times. And Bruce Fine joins us from Washington. Good morning and welcome to WMEB Forum.
Well, thank you. Honored to be with you.
Thank you so much. During this hour again, you, our listener, are invited to join our conversation with your questions, comments, and personal stories about the topic. You can reach us by email at forum@wmub.org, that phone number 888-877-3885. And what we toss out to you, our listeners, is a number of possible areas for you to consider. Are you even aware of this concept of signing statements? Are you concerned that they may be giving the chief executive too much power? If you've never heard of signing statements before our conversation, tell us what you think as you learn about them today. And if you are familiar with this concept of presidential signing statements, do you believe they are an appropriate use of executive powers? Let's start off with Chris Kelly, the basic question of the day. What is a signing statement? Is there a difference between a signing statement and a veto or a line item veto?
There is. The signing statement itself is, as the name suggests, nothing more than a document that the president attaches to a bill that he's just signed into law. And the document itself will explain what the bill does, who worked on the particular piece of legislation, and then what the president thinks about the particular piece of legislation. Generally speaking, most of the signing statements are non-controversial. They are more where a president will congratulate members who worked on the bill with him. Sometimes he'll hold a formal signing ceremony to go along with the signing statement itself. The more controversial signing statements, though, the ones that have brought us here today, occur when the president either interprets vague provisions of the legislation in a way that contradicts perhaps the way Congress had intended the language to be interpreted. And also a president will construct the provisions that he feel are defective in a way that he makes them constitutional. Basically what he says is that he'll find a provision of the bill to be defective in some way, and his understanding of the Constitution then is what he follows up with that statement, and it's that particular use of the signing statement that has really drawn most of the attention to the Bush administration today, simply because he has challenged so many pieces, provisions of bills that he signed into law.
For instance, give us an example of a signing statement that is currently controversial.
Well, there's the signing statement which occurred right around New Year's, 2005-2006, when President Bush signed into law an emergency supplemental. Part of that supplemental contained the provision with respect to how the United States would treat detainees. This was the provision where Senator McCain had lobbied throughout the fall of 2005 to make sure that we didn't mistreat enemy detainees, and the administration pushed hard to carve out exceptions to that provision. When they failed to do so, President Bush had sort of a formal photo op with Senator McCain and Senator John Warner, in which he agreed that McCain's interpretation was the correct interpretation. But when he signed the provision into law, his signing statement construed that in a way that took back the concessions that he had made made with Senator McCain and Senator Warner on the bill.
How can that be? I mean, everything, the basis of law, and even those of us without any background in law at all know that what's on paper is what counts. The Congress, the House, the right. Senate negotiate these bills. They get them through and agree on the language, and it's clear in black and white, literally, what the law is supposed to mean. How can the presidential opinion change the way a law is going to be implemented?
Well, this is what also sort of has turned on the head our understanding of the legislative process. We all remember what we were taught with respect to the legislative process. The Congress gets to draft the bills. The president either signs or vetoes the bills, and then the courts interpret the meaning if there's a challenge. Basically, what we've seen over the past 25 years or so is that there's been this novel approach to executive power, where presidents have asserted the right to independently interpret the meaning of the Constitution and the language of law. Essentially, a president says that I take an oath to protect both the office of the presidency and the Constitution. Therefore, I cannot, in keeping with my oath, I cannot enforce provisions of a bill that I determine to be constitutional. Therefore, I will have to construct those provisions in a way that satisfy my interpretation of the Constitution.
Let's draw in Bruce Fine with the Washington Times, columnist for the Washington Times, an international consultant with the Litchfield Group in Washington, D.C., attorney working with the American Bar Association on their discussion of signing statements. Bruce, is the signing statement essentially encroaching on the authority of both the legislature that is making the laws and on the courts who are appointed to interpret the laws?
Well, let me give you a little bit of background here for the audience. The Founding Fathers understood how to balance the powers of the president with the powers of the legislature in the making of legislation. The president does have a role because he can sign or veto laws. And the Constitution in Article 1, Section 7, Clause 2 gives the president two options, only two options when the House and Senate have passed the bill. It says he can sign the bill, and then he shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed and enforce it, or he can veto the bill and return it to the House in which it originated with a statement of his objections. And the Founding Fathers envisioned that the president would view bills that he thought were unconstitutional as prime targets for the veto. The Founding Fathers knew that the legislature might encroach on the president, just like it could happen in an opposite direction, and the veto power was given as a matter of self-defense. So you can see when the president looks at a bill and says, I think this is unconstitutional, the Founding Fathers intended that he veto the bill, not sign it and then say I won't enforce it. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the very first president, George Washington, said, I either have to sign or veto a bill in toto. I can't just pick and choose amongst those. The signing statements of President Bush in unilaterally nullifying provisions of law that he has signed, they're probably well over 800 at this point, clearly violate what we call the presentment clause of the Constitution, because they are the equivalent of saying, I'm signing the bill, I approve it, I believe it's constitutional at the signing stage, and then at the enforcement stage, he says, nope, you know what, this is a null set. I won't enforce the law even though I've signed it. And if you want to look at the evils of the predecessors and kings of Great Britain that led to the decision of the Founding Fathers to require the president to execute the laws, it fits President Bush's actions like a glove. It was King James II who had dispensed or suspended the enforcement of many laws passed by the Parliament during his reign. And he was dethroned, and the British Parliament in 1688 adopted what's called the English Bill of Rights. And one of those declarations stated that a king, a royal prerogative, does not exist to suspend or dispense with laws passed by the Parliament without parliamentary consent. What President Bush is doing is simply reinstating that suspension or dispensing power, because it says, I see the law, I understand what it means, I won't enforce it.
Bruce Fine is with us on the line. I want to take this another step before we need to take a short break here. Gentlemen, Chris Kelly, when was signing statement first used? How did this practice come into place?
Yeah, well, there's a long precedent for the use of the signing statement, really, in all of its forms. The first documented use of the signing statement occurred in the Monroe administration in the early part of the 19th century, whereby President Monroe signed a bill that dealt with military appointments. And in the bill, in his signing statement, he basically told Congress that he has the power over appointments and not Congress. Sporadically, we saw it used throughout the 19th century. Andrew Jackson used it. But for the most part, it's been a 20th century sort of phenomena.
Okay, we're going to come back to this concept of presidential signing statements, your opinion, your input, your reflections or stories about this issue. Are welcome. Forum at WMUB.org is our email address. Call us at 888-877-3885 or in the Cincinnati area, 529-5200. Presidential signing statements is the topic of this week's WMUB Forum. I'm John Hingsbergen, in for Gary Scott this week with Dr. Chris Kelly and attorney Bruce Fine. Bruce also a columnist for the Washington Times, and we're here to discuss this concept that I guess, Chris, is this somewhat of a wonky sort of a thing that you have to kind of know a lot about politics to even know that signing statements exist, or is it something that the American general public is well aware of at this point?
Well, I think that the public are sort of vaguely aware, given the controversy over President Bush's use of the signing statements, both in the way he has used it over really high-profile bills, plus simply the number of times he's used it. However, for the most part, trying to explain the signing statement itself, it really is more wonkish than anything else. But I think Americans understand, though, the sense of what's right and what's wrong with respect to the Constitution. And this clearly is something that has smacked Americans as being something wrong.
The signing statement can have a very, very dramatic impact upon the fate of the United States and clashes. Think of this situation. Congress enacts a law prohibiting any monies of the United States to be used to conduct military operations against Iran's nuclear facilities. They are worried about the crazy mullahs there perhaps taking retaliation. The president signs the bill, so there's no opportunity for an override. And then he says, I think this encroaches on my commander-in-chief powers, and therefore this is null and void, and then proceeds to conduct a military operation against Iran's nuclear facilities. There we have the president there exercising the equivalent of an absolute veto, because there's no opportunity to override a signing statement just saying I'm not going to enforce the law.
Well, let's pick up on this issue of
single-handedly getting us involved in military operations.
How does this relate to vetoes? I mean, I know presidents, and I am trying to think, was it President Reagan who was pushing real hard for a line item veto because there were so many budgets going through with which he had some serious disagreement? The line item veto was not granted. Does this become effectively a line item veto that allowing presidents to pick and choose what he wants to enforce?
Well, there are people who have characterized the signing statement as a sort of ironclad item veto for the reasons that Bruce just explained. And that is the president will essentially, refuse to enforce because he disagrees with it, but Congress doesn't have any opportunity to respond to it or to override it. So in that sense, it is like an item veto.
Bruce?
And the Supreme Court held the line item veto, with less than an absolute one, unconstitutional in a case called Clinton versus New York in 1998. We had someone, William Rehnquist, before he was Chief Justice of the United States, as head of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice under President Nixon, said, gee, a president's duty to faithfully execute the laws doesn't include the duty not to faithfully execute the laws. And Chief Justice Rehnquist was a strong proponent of executive power.
In the interest of our attempt to, you know, have some balance in this conversation, who supports, beside, I would imagine, the president, who supports or endorses this concept of signing statements? Is this something that generally is supported by the president's party, by the Republican Party, by certain groups within our Congress?
Well, you have actually there is a great deal of support for the signing statement. In fact, there is a great deal of support among former Clinton Justice Department officials.
So it's not purely a partisan issue.
No, it's not. And the support essentially falls in line such as this, that the president is faced with such large bills that fund hundreds and hundreds of programs. Therefore, when he is given a bill, particularly an important spending bill, oftentimes it may contain 99% of the things that he likes, and there's only a few things that he doesn't like. And rather than exercising the veto and perhaps shutting down a whole portion of government, he'll use the signing statement as a way to communicate with members of Congress that this essentially are the things that he found defective, and in some instances he would urge Congress in the future to either avoid adding these sorts of things to the bill, or he urges Congress to make technical corrections to defects that he found in a particular provision of the bill. So there are supporters, and there certainly are supporters, both Democrat and Republican.
Well, Bruce Fine, as a participant in the hearings, concerning the use of signing statements, what was the result of this process? Was there some recommended action? I mean, is something coming about as a result?
Well, the Senator Specter asked me, and I sent to him a draft bill that empowers the House of Representatives and the Senate collectively to sue the president in federal court seeking a declaratory judgment that a president's refusal to veto a bill he thinks is unconstitutional and give Congress the opportunity to override it, and in lieu of a veto, simply signing the bill, burying it so Congress cannot override it, and then he ends up enforcing a law that Congress did not pass, because Congress passes a whole law. And as you well know, in the way in which the votes are cast, some members would cast a vote for an entire bill, but they wouldn't have cast that same vote if they knew certain parts would be delimbed. And so you have a second violation of legislative prerogative here, not only being denied the right to override a presidential veto, but also the right to decide what laws are passed, the passage of the laws that Congress voted on, or the laws that Congress voted on and then the president turned into his form of Swiss cheese. And it's that concrete injury to the institutional powers of Congress that I have suggested gives them standing, that's a technical legal term, to bring the president to court and seek a declaratory judgment that a president has only two options when he confronts a bill passed by the Congress: sign all of it or veto and enforce it, or veto it and send it back to Congress for an opportunity to override. I think it's also important historically to note that these claims that if you have an omnibus bill with one defective provision in, the president is being coerced into signing the whole bill is false. The presidents have in the past said, well, this is a huge bill, this provision is defective, I'm vetoing it, but if you delete the defective provision, I'll sign it. And Congress invariably will take that message and repass the bill without the defective provisions. If it's overwhelmingly necessary to fund the government, Congress will respond to those demands by the president that they delete one or two provisions out of a 1,000-page bill.
We want to invite our listeners to be part of this conversation on presidential signing statements. The phone number is 888-877-3885. Call in with your questions, your comments, or your reactions to this concept, or send an email to forum@wmub.org. Gentlemen, we do have an email from Mark, who says, I have been following Professor Kelly's research on this for quite some time. Would he and Mr. Fine comment on the role of the Internet and new media in bringing the subject to the attention of the public?
I think that the Internet, particularly by making this obscure topic that we're talking about accessible to the public, has been a wonderful help. For instance, there is an attorney out in Oklahoma who on her own time has assembled an annotated database of all of President Bush's signing statements, so that you can see not only the language of the signing statements, but you can also click on parts of the signing statement that will take you to the provision of the laws that the president is objecting to.
And how many signing statements has President Bush II signed?
By my count, he has challenged 955 separate and distinct provisions of law.
And the second highest contender in that
was his father.
Honor?
Yes. Okay. And he behaves very much like his father did when he was in office. So the Internet, I think, has done a great deal to inform individuals on a topic that prior to the Internet and the information age, I don't think it would have been accessible.
Bruce Fine?
One of the things that the task force recommended was that Congress enact a law requiring the president to publish in a form that's accessible all the signing statements. So this ingenious and very laudable voluntary effort to make these statements accessible to the American people is not required, and that the signing statements would be compiled in the same regularized format as U.S. laws and regulations in the Federal Register.
Okay,
and I think that would be an exceptionally helpful way in which the debate and understanding of the presidential signing statements would be enhanced.
We need to take a short break for some news from National Public Radio. This is WMEB Forum. Presidential signing statements, the topic of this week's program. Your input is invited. Send an email to forum@wmub.org. Our phone number, 888-877-3885. We want to touch base on this court ruling yesterday regarding the internal or security measures taken by the Bush administration. That coming up in just a few minutes on WMUB Forum. This is WMUB Forum on NPR at 88.5. I'm John Hingsbergen, and our conversation today is about the issue of presidential signing statements. And if this is a fairly new concept to you, don't be surprised. There are a lot of us who really have never thought of it in those terms. We are hearing stories about presidential powers and the issue of president, the legislature, and the judicial branch of government constantly in a little bit of a tug of war, I guess. I mean, it's part of the system that was set up by the framers of the U.S. Constitution, a balance of powers. And we have chosen to air this topic today because we have access to Professor Chris Kelly, who is an assistant, visiting assistant professor of political science at Miami University. He's one of a few scholars researching this issue of presidential signing statements. He operates a blog called Media Watch. How does one find that if we talked about the Internet and the access to this information?
The Media Watch blog is on the Miami servers. It's off of my Miami homepage, and you can access it by going to the Miami homepage, WMU muohio.edu and just searching for my name. It'll pop right up.
Search box at the top of the page. Type in Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, it should pop right up.
And Bruce Fine is also with us, a member of the American Bar Association Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the issue. He's a constitutional lawyer and international consultant with the Litchfield Group in Washington, D.C. Writes a column on legal and international affairs for the Washington Times. And, Bruce, anything you'd like to plug in terms of contact, how listeners may follow up on the information that you're providing here as well?
You can just click my name on Google, and that would more than ample for nighttime reading.
If we spell it correctly, F-E-I-N, right?
Yes.
All right. That's Bruce Fine. Well, let's come back to this topic of presidential signing statements. Chris, you were saying you had some comments about Bruce's most recent remarks about the availability of the information.
A couple of things. Also, in addition to the bill that Senator Spector introduced, there's also legislation that Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts also has introduced, which requires that the president notify the Congress when he is making these constitutional challenges. However, the interesting thing to note about that is that in 2002, Senator Leahy, Patrick Leahy of Vermont, added language to a Department of Justice appropriation bill requiring that the Attorney General inform the Congress whenever the President either refuses to defend an unconstitutional provision of law or enforce a provision of law that the President has determined to be unconstitutional. And despite the fact that Senator Leahy successfully added that language to the appropriations bill, when President Bush signed that particular Department of Justice appropriations bill, he used a signing statement to essentially opt himself out of the mandate that Senator Leahy had added to that appropriations bill. I have a Freedom of Information Act request with the Department of Justice asking whether or not they have fulfilled their constitutional obligation to inform Congress, and I just received a note yesterday from them in which they told me they cannot find any evidence that they have.
Just yesterday, the news came out, and of course it's still very much in the news today, that a federal judge in Detroit ordered an immediate halt to the federal government's warrantless wiretapping program. Is there a connection to the signing statements and this whole process, Bruce Fine? Do you see these as related?
There's been a systematic campaign by the Bush administration from the outset to cripple the powers of Congress and emulating King Louis the 14th saying, I am the law. That's the president. And this is the domestic warrantless surveillance program in flagrant contradiction of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act fits into this larger pattern combined with the presidential signing statements, combined with the president's unilateral creation of a military tribunal for alleged war criminals that the Supreme Court struck down, combined with the president's assertion that he could detain you, me, anyone in the United States as an illegal combatant for our lives without having any judicial review. So this is a part of this quest to move towards a single branch of government, the presidential powers that he styles a unitary executive. Now, one of the things that's important to note about this domestic surveillance program is that there's no evidence at all that it is at all critical or even marginally important to our national security. Everyone understands the Constitution is not a suicide pact. The United States, the Congress, and the President have ample powers to try to protect us against 9/11 or sequels to 9/11. In 2002, it was Bush's Justice Department that told the Senate Intelligence Committee that the current statutory arrangements called FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, enabled the executive to act nimbly, quickly, flexibly in order to stop terrorism at the bud. And there has not been a single shred of evidence forthcoming directly or by leaks from the administration that this domestic surveillance program has led to the foiling of any terrorist plot. And everyone knows in Washington that if there were a great success story, it would be leaked out into the papers in half a second's time. Another earmark of the, in my judgment, the gratuitous nature of this violation of law is the fact that the administration has conceded it does not use this warrantless program to intercept domestic-to-domestic calls, the kinds of real-time information that might enable you to actually stop a terrorist attack as it was emerging on the ground. And the administration's effort is really just to try to frighten people and think that they are being more muscular against terrorism as opposed to the Democrats for their political advantage. Mm-hmm. It's as crass and cynical as that, in my judgment. And this claim that the administration has been seeking all along, you know, to get a final definitive judicial ruling on what, whether the doing is constitutional is laughable. For 5 years, the administration could have instantly have had judicial review of their warrantless surveillance program simply by using some of the information either in a criminal prosecution, enabling a defendant to challenge the legality of the program, or in seeking a warrant under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And they've avoided, like the plague, mm-hmm. ever having the court look at this with any kind of scrutiny.
Bruce Fein is with us.
Here.
Bruce Fein is with us from Washington, D.C. He is was a member of the American Bar Association Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He's testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, clearly an opponent of the concept of presidential signing statements. We have Professor Chris Kelly at Miami University, political science. He's a visiting assistant professor. We're interested in your input on this topic. We encourage you to be part of the conversation, and we're going to get to the phone lines in just a moment here at 888-877-3885, and we're interested, of course, in those who would agree with or defend the concept of signing statements. We don't want to just do a program that completely attacks this concept. We want to hear from those who think that this is a good idea or those who are concerned about the issue. We're going to get to Bob from Cheviot in just a moment here. Chris Kelly, did you have a comment you wanted to interject before we get to Bob?
I do. There also is responsibilities of the Congress to be aggressive in challenging presidents who use the signing statements or basically executive power in the way that the Bush administration has. The Constitution Project, for example, which is a bipartisan group of scholars, politicians, and others who also are interested in the administration's exercise of power. It, too, had a study of the signing statement and issued recommendations. And one of the recommendations, which I think is a good one, that they made was that Congress should be checking executive power. It should be, for example, denying appropriations to the administration when it thinks that it has overstepped its power. This was a Congress that, at least during the 8 years of the Clinton administration, that was very aggressive in defending its prerogatives and very aggressive in forcing administration officials to come testify and so forth, and we've not seen that since President Bush has come to power.
We're going to come back and talk to Bob from Cheviot. And we have a line open for you if you have a question or a comment about this concept of presidential signing statements. 888-877-3885 in the Cincinnati area. It's 529-5200. Send us an email to forum@wmub.org. More WMUB Forum in a minute and a half. NPR at 88.5 WMUB. This week's topic, presidential signing statements. We have two experts on the topic, Professor Chris Kelly, visiting assistant professor of political science at Miami University, attorney and member of the American Bar Association Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements, Bruce Fein, who also testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee on this issue. He's a constitutional lawyer and international consultant with the Litchfield Group in Washington, D.C., a columnist also for the Washington Times. And let's go to the phone at 888-877-3885. Bob from Cheviot, tell us your question or your comment.
Well, you know, I just wanted to express my cynicism about what can be done about this, and even despair at times. There's just no oversight. There's short of changing the Congress into a more combative type thing, or someone with some checks and balances. I don't see any chance at all. I mean, you couldn't even get Arlen Specter to put the Gonzalez under oath to answer questions. I mean, you know, it just, And even if we could change Congress, would that make a difference? I mean, the Democrats have been bootlicking for 6 years now, or however long the Republicans have been in control. I don't see it changing, and I just like an opinion.
Well, they're
bleak.
Let's go ahead. Yeah, since we can't see Bruce, let's let him get involved here. Go ahead.
I think the voters have a chance to give some vertebrae to Congress, which has turned spineless with the Republican in the White House, and that is during campaigns you need to ask candidates, how are you going to vote on presidential powers? Will you use the power of the purse to tell the president that he has no money to run programs unless he discloses information to Congress, that he has no money to execute the laws when he issues signing statements? These have to be a staple of the debate during campaigns. If it's not, remember, this is our government. That's what the Declaration of Independence, government by the consent of the governed. And that's the great thing about this country. We can demand answers and hold officials accountable, and the political process is one of those methods. I would hope that in 2008, programs like this will be asking candidates for the presidency, well, what is your view of signing statements? What is your view of flouting the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act? What is your view of conducting military tactics on the streets of Ohio under the theory that all the world is a battlefield after 9/11? If these things become part of the staple of discussion in American politics, things will change. If the American people don't care, I can guarantee you Congress is not. And when I have testified on repeated occasions before both the Senate and the House, I get questions from members saying, well, I'm not getting thousands of letters in, so why should I care about this, Mr. Fine? Well, they need to get thousands of letters in, and then they will care.
Chris Kelly?
I think that's exactly right. The press, you would think, for example, that the press could do a great service to pushing Congress into challenging the president simply by focusing on this issue and making it known every time that the administration issues these sorts of challenges, but it doesn't. I mean, it was sort of the topic du jour for a while, and it's kind of faded. And despite the fact the attention that it got when President Bush signed the pension bill yesterday, in his signing statement, he issued three more constitutional challenges to a bill that he had just signed. So the press isn't going to be sufficient in this cause. It will take an aggravation by the American public that forces wind behind the sails of the Congress.
Okay, Bob, thank you so much for raising that question. 888-877-3885. Send an email to forum@wmub.org. Bruce Fine, I understand that you played a role in the Reagan administration and that perhaps your opinion of some of these issues has shifted in the last couple of decades. Tell us more about that.
I wouldn't say that. There are two different kinds of signing statements. In the Reagan administration, then and now, I support the idea of a signing statement not of the type that nullifies a law, that understands, however, that the president has a role in fashioning legislation that's presented to him. As anyone knows, the president and his subordinates oftentimes are negotiating with members of the House and Senate over language of a bill that would be acceptable but not provoke a veto. And the view of a signing statement that I think is wholly legitimate is one where the president says, all right, I've got this bill. There are some provisions here that are ambiguous. And I have had a role in drafting this legislation every bit as much as Congress has. My view of the legislation is that this term means X. He doesn't say I'm not going to enforce the law. It says in enacting the legislation, my view was considered as well as the congressional view, and this was the compromise language. That seems to me totally legitimate. The president's view is not binding upon the courts, but it has some proper influence, just like a single member of Congress standing on the floor and saying, I think when we pass this bill, this term means X, or a committee report voices a view of how a particular term ought to be interpreted, is given some weight, even though the president cannot veto a committee report, he cannot veto a member's statement on the floor of Congress. That is, however, a far different concept, because that situation is one, I am enforcing the law, but this ambiguity, in my term, it should be interpreted in this way, given my view of how the legislative process unfolded compared with the committee report.
How did President Reagan use the signing statements? Were there some specifics that we would be familiar with, if you could point them out to us?
Well, they're nothing like the Detainee Treatment Act that Chris pointed out on the anti-torture provision, or there's a regular Intelligence Authorization Act that instructs President Bush not to use our military forces in Colombo to attack Colombia to attack narco terrorists, which he repeatedly says I'll just view as hortatory and will not pay any attention to. So there were, however, provisions relating to certain contracting rules that ended up in a lot of litigation where the Reagan administration lost. This was one that was alleged to infringe on the president's authority to faithfully execute certain contracting decisions and free from the oversight of the General Accounting Office. So I'm not saying that the Reagan administration, whether or not, because I wasn't the one certainly who was responsible for the vast majority of his signing statements, may not have overstepped the bounds. But I have never, my view of signing statements, the only one are legitimate is those that address the president's role in fashioning legislation, not any presidential authority simply to decide on his own. He simply won't enforce the law, the one that he signed himself. And this is one of the basic contradictions, it seems to me, with regard to the proponents of the signing statements. They say, well, he has an obligation to defend the Constitution, so how can he enforce a law that he believes is unconstitutional? But then you have to ask, go a step forward. How can he sign a law that he thinks is unconstitutional and say he's faithfully defending the Constitution? The Founding Fathers wanted him to veto those bills he thought were unconstitutional. In the history of the United States, 217 years, there have been about 28 instances when the president vetoed a bill on constitutional grounds. And in only one of those cases did that veto get overridden and create a constitutional battle. This was in 1867. So if you do it the right way, you get one problem in 217 years. That's a pretty good record for the Founding Fathers.
We're talking about presidential signing statements on this week's WMUB Forum. A few minutes remaining for you to express your opinion or pose a question for our guests. 888-877-3885 or 529-5200 in area code 513. Our email address, forum@wmub.org. Please feel free to jump on board with your question or your comment. Is there any activity, Chris Kelly, in the Congress or in the courts that is challenging the use of presidential signing statements within this constitutionally prescribed balance of power?
Well, besides the couple pieces of legislation that have been introduced in the House and the Senate, you basically that's really just about it. The courts have sort of hit or miss with respect to taking these signing statements into account when they're deciding their decisions. There was a lot of anxiety, for example, during the Reagan administration that the fear was that the administration was trying to influence the decision of judges by putting signing statements into the legislative history of all bills that he signs into law. Clearly that I don't think has been much of a problem. But with respect to the bills that are going through Congress, I mean, these bills face an uphill battle. I mean, they face the uphill battle just in the formal process of getting passed by Congress and actually either signed by President Bush or having his veto overridden, perhaps his second veto. But in addition to those problems, I think the legislation also has the problem of Republicans inside the Congress undermining the legislation itself. With respect, for example, to Senator Specter and his ability to hold hearings on this, he has been undermined by Republican members of the Senate Judiciary Committee to hold these kind of hearings as a way to protect the president. So I think going into the 2006 midterms, I don't know that this is likely something that is going to weigh heavy on the Congress with respect to it passing.
Bruce Fine, what are we going to see in terms of activity in the coming months or the next couple of years related to signing statements?
Well, with the next couple of months, I don't think we're going to see any activity at all. It's, I helped draft the bill that Senator Specter introduced. It hasn't gotten the groundswell of co-sponsorships on the Republican side. I know I've worked with Senator Russ Feingold's office in Wisconsin, so there may be, you know, a growing eagerness of the Democrats to be co-sponsors, but they're not. I do think, however, that in all cases like this, there needs to be a public educational process of the type of this program, so that it filters down the American people know how dangerous this particular proposition is. And it's not impossible that the public sentiment can force congressional action. And I think about President Franklin D. Roosevelt's court packing plan after he won a landslide victory in 1936. The public just sensed there was something wrong, institutionally wrong, about trying to pack and manipulate the Supreme Court to help the president, even if he was overwhelmingly popular. And it's that kind of public anxiety and worry that I think that could spur Congress, not this year, but perhaps in the next Congress, to take action against the signing statement through the power of the purse or otherwise.
We're just about out of time. Each of you, 30 seconds, your recommendation for how our listeners could learn more about this issue or get involved.
I think the internet provides a perfect tool to stay on top of this. In addition to the internet, I think that there continues at least to be editorials written about the signing statement, op-ed pieces about the signing statement. So I think that there is ample opportunity for the American public to make itself aware and knowledgeable about the topic.
Bruce?
Well, I would suggest, as a primer anyway, just reading through the transcript and the written statements that were submitted during Senator Spector's hearing on signing statements held earlier this year. And it's information that's written in prose that's accessible, not too filled with the patois of lawyers.
All right. Well, Chris Kelly and Bruce Fine, thank you both so much for being part of this conversation on presidential signing statements. We do have some links on our website, WMUB.org. If you click on the WMUB forum banner, you'll find a link to Chris Kelly's page on the Miami University website. You'll find a link to the American Bar Association Task Force on Signing Statements that involved Bruce Fine, and also a link to his his law firm, the Litchfield Group. But thank you both for being part of the program today.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
We encourage our listeners to visit our website, WMUB.org, for more information about this topic, plus links for podcasting and web streaming on our website. Again, that's WMUB.org. Views and opinions expressed in this program are those of our listeners and our guests, and not necessarily of WMUB or our licensee, Miami University. Today's producers were Grant Gerlach and John Hoffman. Grant has been at the controls as well. I'm John Hingsbergen, encouraging you to tune in for an encore presentation of Forum next week, hosted by Gary Scott. And, of course, tune in every Friday morning between 9 and 10 o'clock. The show repeats in the evening at 7 o'clock on NPR at 88.5 WMUB.